Before dawn, August 1, 1943, a series of baking desert airfields outside Benghazi, Libya. 178 consolidated B-24 Liberators are being fueled and armed in the darkness. Their four big Pratt & Whitney radials are silent for the moment. Bomb bays are loaded. Crew chiefs are making their final checks. The men who will fly these aircraft are getting their briefings, and some of what they're hearing is making them go quiet in ways that have nothing to do with military discipline. The target is Ploiești, Romania. The oil refineries there, strung along the Prahova Valley north of Bucharest, supply a significant fraction of all the refined petroleum that fuels the German war machine, aviation gasoline, diesel for the tanks, lubricants for the factories. A substantial share of it flows through Ploiești. The Allies have been watching those refineries for a long time, and now they're going to hit them. But not from high altitude, where the bombers are safer and the bombs less precise. The plan calls for these aircraft to come in at treetop level, below 500 feet, in some places below 200. Low enough to see the faces of people in the fields below, low enough that bomb fuses are set on delay so the aircraft can clear its own blast before detonation. Because if you're at 200 feet when your bombs go off, you're in serious trouble. Nobody has ever attempted anything quite like this against a target as heavily defended as Ploiești. This is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger. Today we're talking about Operation Tidal Wave, August 1, 1943. The low-level mission to Romania that became one of the most costly airstrikes in the history of the Army Air Forces, and the single mission that produced more medals of honor than any other day of the entire war. Pull up a chair. This one takes a few minutes to do right. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. To understand what made Ploiești worth such a desperate gamble, you have to understand the role of oil in the Second World War. By the summer of 1943, Allied planners had identified the Ploiești refinery complex as one of the most critical industrial targets in all of Europe. Some estimates put Germany's dependence on Ploiești at roughly a third of its total refined oil supply. The aviation fuel, the diesel for the panzer divisions, the bunker oil for the U-boats, enormous quantities of all of it flowed through that valley in Romania. Hit Ploiești hard enough and you were squeezing one of the fundamental arteries of the German military. The logic of the low-level approach was straightforward, even if the execution was anything but. High-altitude precision bombing was still an imprecise art in 1943. You dropped a lot of bombs to hit a specific building from 20,000 feet, at treetop level. A good bombardier could put ordnance exactly where it needed to go. The refineries were large industrial targets, yes, but they were also complex. Storage tanks, distillation towers, cracking units, pumping stations. You needed your bombs to land in specific places to do real damage. The drawback was obvious to anyone who had ever sat in a cockpit. At low level, you lose the altitude that gives you time to recover from damage. You give the anti-aircraft gunners the target geometry they dream about. You're flying straight at them, and they can see you coming from miles away. The mission planners knew all of this. They built in the element of surprise as the key mitigating factor. If the formation could arrive without warning, at an altitude where the heavy flak guns could not depress their barrels far enough to track them, the losses might be manageable. That is the plan. Now here's what happened. Five bomb groups were assigned to Operation Tidal Wave. The 93rd, the 98th, the 44th, the 389th, and the 376th. These were seasoned outfits with experienced crews who had flown missions over occupied Europe before. They spent weeks training on a full-scale mock-up of the Ploiești complex built in the Libyan desert. They flew the approach profiles at low level until they could do it in their sleep. Each group was assigned specific refineries within the target area. The timing was coordinated so that the groups would arrive in sequence without overlapping, without flying through the blast and smoke of the group ahead of them. On paper, it was workable, just barely, but workable. The formation left Benghazi in the early morning hours of August 1st and headed north across the Mediterranean. Before they were even across the Ionian Sea, one aircraft went down. The crew was lost, and while that was a blow, the formation pressed on, climbing toward the Albanian coast, crossing the mountains of Yugoslavia, then beginning their long descent toward the Romanian plains. That descent is where the mission's careful choreography began to come apart. As the lead elements approached the target area, a navigational error was made at a critical checkpoint. Instead of turning toward Ploiești, the lead group turned south, toward Bucharest, some 30 miles in the wrong direction. It was several agonizing minutes before the error was recognized and a correction made. By then, the synchronized formation had fractured. Groups were separated. Some were on their correct approach. Others were arriving late, from wrong headings, into smoke and flame from aircraft that had already made their runs. And the element of surprise was gone. Romanian and German radar had been tracking the formation for some time. The flak batteries were manned and ready. Fighter interceptors were already airborne when the first B-24s came over the ridge and down onto the deck. What those crews flew into over Ploiesti was unlike anything they had experienced. The anti-aircraft defenses around those refineries were among the densest in Europe. Guns were positioned in towers built directly into the refinery complexes. They were concealed in farmhouses and haystacks along the approach routes. And unlike the high-altitude flak that experienced bomber crews had learned to read and navigate around, this was direct fire, point-blank. Gunners who could look the pilots in the eyes. Tracer rounds at eye level, aircraft going down not above and around the formation but beside it. So close the pressure waves rocked your wings. And those crews flew straight through it. One of the most defining moments of the mission involved the 93rd Bomb Group, led by Lieutenant Colonel Addison Baker, with Major John Gerstad flying as his co-pilot. Their B-24 took catastrophic hits on the approach to the target. The aircraft was on fire from nose to tail, visible to every crew in the formation. Baker had altitude and he had airspeed. He could have broken off the run, tried to find open ground, tried to save his crew. Instead, he held the aircraft straight and level, maintained his position at the front of the formation, and continued the approach until his bombardiers released their bombs on target. The airplane went down. Neither Baker nor Gerstad survived. Both men were awarded the Medal of Honor. Both citations were presented posthumously. In another part of the formation, Colonel Leon Johnson of the 44th Bomb Group arrived at his assigned target to find it already burning from a group that had hit it ahead of schedule, the result of the navigational confusion. The smoke was thick enough to reduce visibility to nearly nothing. The fires were intense, fed by ruptured storage tanks. Johnson could have made the reasonable assessment that his target had already been struck and broken off to find a secondary. Instead, he led his group into the smoke and the fire to ensure that his assigned refineries were struck. Johnson survived. He received the Medal of Honor, Colonel John Kane of the 98th Bomb Group. A man his crews called Killer Kane, not without affection, held his formation together through conditions that would have scattered a less experienced unit. His aircraft took hits. The situation in and around the target area was, to use the most honest word available, chaos. Kane kept flying. Kane survived. Medal of Honor. And then there was Second Lieutenant Lloyd Hughes of the 389th Bomb Group. Hughes was 22 years old, on the approach to his assigned target. Hughes's B-24 took hits in the fuel system. Gasoline was streaming from the aircraft in sheets, trailing behind the plane in the slipstream. Any crew in the formation who looked over could see it. Hughes certainly knew it. One spark, one piece of hot metal from the refinery structures he was about to fly through. That was the margin between completing the mission and being incinerated before the bombs even left the bay. Hughes held the approach. He kept the aircraft in formation. He flew through the target area so his crew could complete their bomb run. On the pullout from the target, the fuel caught. Lloyd Hughes was 22 years old, Medal of Honor, posthumous, 5 Medals of Honor from a single mission. That number has no equal in the history of American air power. In a single afternoon, over a single target in southern Romania, 5 men were recognized with the nation's highest military honor. 3 of them did not come home. When the survivors straggled back to those Libyan airfields, some of them landing at fields other than their own because the fuel was gone, because the aircraft were too damaged to make another 50 miles. The accounting was brutal even by the standards of the air war over Europe. Of the 178 B-24s that had left that morning, 53 did not return. Over 600 men were killed. More than 100 were taken prisoner. Dozens more put their damaged aircraft down in neutral Turkey and spent the rest of the war interned there, alive but grounded, sitting in a limbo that was safe and must have felt like its own kind of imprisonment. The damage to Ploiesti was real. Several of the most important refinery complexes were hit hard. Production was disrupted. But here's the arithmetic, and the mission planners knew this going in and had to weigh it. The refineries were not knocked out permanently. German and Romanian engineers went to work on the repairs immediately. Within weeks, production was recovering. Within months, Ploiesti was operating close to its pre-raid capacity again. It was the sustained Allied bombing campaign of 1944, conducted from high altitude over many missions, that ultimately broke Ploiesti's output and made the oil shortage felt by German forces in the field, not a single dramatic stroke. Now here's where it gets interesting, and I say that knowing the word doesn't quite cover it. Some historians have argued that Tidal Wave was a mission whose concept outran its feasibility from the start. The element of surprise that the whole plan rested on was compromised before the formation reached the target. The navigational error that fractured the timing was the kind of cascade that low-level attacks, with their compressed decision windows, make almost impossible to recover from. And the defenses at Ploesti were formidable enough that a low-level approach was going to be costly under almost any circumstances. Others argue that the temporary disruption had real effects, that the intelligence gathered informed the later high-altitude campaign, and that the strategic message sent by striking that deep into southeastern Europe was worth something in itself. Both arguments have merit, and honest people have disagreed about them for 80 years. What is not in dispute is this: those men knew, going into those briefings in the Libyan heat, exactly what they were being asked to fly into. The training on the desert mock-up had made the risk completely transparent. There was no ambiguity about what treetop level over a heavily defended target meant. Every one of them climbed into those aircraft anyway. They pulled the throttles forward and pointed the nose north toward the sea and flew 1,000 miles to put themselves at the end of German gun barrels. That is worth sitting with for a moment. The B-24 Liberator doesn't get the same treatment in the popular imagination as some of its contemporaries. It lacks the elegant lines of the Boeing B-17 Flying Fortress. It's wider, heavier, more industrial-looking. Crews who flew both aircraft often preferred the 17. The Liberator had a reputation for being demanding in close formation and less forgiving at slow speeds. Its shoulder-mounted Davis wing gave it exceptional range but created handling characteristics that took some getting used to. But the Liberator was the workhorse. More B-24s were built than any other American aircraft of the Second World War. Over 18,000 of them, they flew in every theater, from the Pacific Islands to the Himalayan supply routes to the Atlantic anti-submarine patrols. Wherever the war was, odds were there was a Liberator in the vicinity. And on August 1, 1943, they were at Ploesti. There are a handful of surviving B-24 airframes in collections around the country today. The Air Force Museum in Dayton has one. A few partial examples exist in various restoration states. If you ever get the chance to stand next to one, really stand close and look at how large these aircraft were. How cramped the crew positions were inside that fuselage. How many systems had to function correctly for those men to survive a mission like the one we have been talking about. I would encourage you to take a few minutes with it. Stand there and think about flying it at 200 feet above the ground, through smoke and fire and concentrated flak, for reasons that had nothing to do with personal survival. That is the kind of thought that recalibrates things in a way statistics never quite can. The men of Operation Tidal Wave are commemorated at the American Military Cemetery in Bari, Italy. Some are buried there, others have no known grave. The mission is remembered on August 1st by a diminishing number of people who feel the date is worth marking. Most of the world has forgotten. You do not have to. My sources today include James Dugan and Carol Stewart's book Ploesti, published in 1962, and still the most thorough account of the mission, along with the official Army Air Force's historical record and the Medal of Honor citations on file with the Department of Defense. More at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Those crews deserved better than what that day handed them. They flew it anyway.